Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 406 of the podcast. And it's Thursday, 6th of December, 2018, as I record this. I am off to New Zealand tomorrow. And in fact, I'll be in Auckland by the time this goes out, although apparently it's raining a lot. So we'll be taking the raincoat. So my husband is a New Zealander. So this is a family trip. Of course, if you listened in last week, you might know I lived there for 7 years, and I'm also a citizen, so this is definitely a sort of personal trip back. I haven't been for 2 years, although Jonathan has been back several times. So looking forward to a break. I'm intending to do a lot of reading and also strategic thinking for my 2019, also fun stuff. So if you want to see pictures, you can follow along at on Instagram. And I'm JF Penn Author on Instagram. And that's the primary place I share my pictures now. So today I am really thrilled to bring you an interview with Yarrow Starek, who, as I mentioned last week, was my mentor at the beginning of my journey. And thank you to everyone who said I've been a mentor to you on your journey. And so interviewing Yarrow is always a pleasure. He's been on the show a couple of times, but this one I really wanted to talk about what business looks like as you take things further. So he's been doing this, I guess, 15 plus years. So I wanted to know, like, what happens after the 10-year mark? And, you know, we discussed boundaries. So one of the things he definitely has, which I do not have and I want to move towards, is true freedom. So I do have the freedom to choose what my time looks like to a point, because as many of you will know, being an author is not, and making a living with your writing, it's not a passive income choice at all. And in fact, I definitely work more hours than I did in a day job. Now, I love what I do, but my next step, and what Yarrow managed to do, was really look at freedom, both of time and money, and also mindset. So rather than worrying about things, really making the most of sort of enjoying life, but also looking at investments. So we talk a bit about investments, and this is definitely something I've been looking at the last couple of years, and certainly doing more with, so that you can have an income that is not reliant on your creative output. And of course, I've talked before about the importance of having a business that means you can look after loved ones in difficult situations. And I definitely have that. But what I feel is that I don't necessarily have an income I do have a little, you know, I could last a little while, but depending on what happened, I don't know if I would be happy sort of leaving the business entirely passive while if I was sick. So this is a really interesting question. And yes, this is an advanced episode, definitely, because many of you might still be sort of starting out with your first book. But the idea of freedom, the idea of boundaries, the idea of investments, these are all things that anyone can be thinking about at any stage of their career. So I really hope you find this useful today. And of course, as ever, I'm honest about my questions with Yarrow, so you can listen into that. And Yarrow does have a fully updated blog profits blueprint, which is what I first used. And of course, I borrowed the idea of the blueprint for my own giveaway and modelled it very definitely on Yarrow's. And I have a link if you are interested, thecreativepen.com/blog blueprint. So that will take you to Yarrow's blog profits blueprint, which is how I got started with online business. In publishing news, so the Future Book Conference happened in London last week. And I think what's interesting about the Future Book Conference is it's not really about the future. It's the audience is mainstream publishing. So when they start talking about things at the Future Book, you know it's starting to hit the mainstream. So they had this really funny slide that I saw. I didn't actually go, but I saw, I was monitoring the Twitter feed and looking at the various articles. And I'll link to one of the roundups from the bookseller in the show notes. But they had this hilarious slide where they defined what AR, VR, AI and other sorts of acronyms stood for. And if you don't know, AR is augmented reality, and fascinating to see Bose put out a pair of quite stylish glasses this week, which will be augmented reality with audio, which I found fascinating. Then also they talked about VR, virtual reality, and AI, artificial intelligence, which of course I talk about a lot. They also had a big session on podcasting and just a load of stuff on audiobooks in general. So obviously I've talked about those things. I think they are not necessarily future. They're kind of, you know, a lot of this stuff is here already. It's just not evenly distributed, as the famous quote by somebody famous said. I want to say Arthur C. Clarke, but there we go. Right. So I did pick out a couple of interesting tweets from the Future Book Twitter feed, so you can have a look at that. There, one poet, Sophia Thakur, did a talk, and she said that she did an Instagram poll about poetry, and she's has a big Instagram following, like a lot of Insta poets, and found that a lot of respondents said they didn't buy poetry, but they would listen to poetry in audio. So I think that's fascinating. And of course, and I actually have a couple of poetry, spoken word, you know, poetry audiobooks, where I don't just binge listen, I listen to a little bit at a time. So the one I've got right now is Kate Tempest, her latest one. So I thought that was interesting. And if you are a poet, that might interest you. Also, they talked about podcasts. So it says podcasts are able to reach more people than events. And at least 40% of this example podcast listens every month are backlist. So it's evergreen. Same here. I mean, I would say we get, you are one of around 15,000 listens per week. But that's for the new episodes, whereas actually the number of listens goes up every month because people are finding the show. Welcome if you're new to the show, and go and listen to the backlist. And it was interesting, the month that I put the show onto Spotify, and hello if you're listening on Spotify, the month I put it on Spotify, my bill for hosting was massive, because I think a lot of people went and downloaded a whole load of backlist shows. So that's really fascinating. Also, just a couple of other things. They say publishing can be somewhat naive, presenting AI as a choice when that is not the case. And that was a kind of presentation saying, look, AI is happening. You don't have a choice. This is what's happening. So embrace it. Don't try and resist. Do not resist our AI overlords. The digitization of the book industry is just starting. The best is yet to come. And I feel this too. I still get emails with people, especially after last week's show with the 10-year thing, saying, is it too late for me to start now? And I just, it's not too late. Every day is day one, as Jeff Bezos says. Oh, I'm just full of quotes today. But basically, yeah, the digitization is definitely, I feel like we're in this kind of toddler phase, and then some, like the voice first stuff, which I'll be talking about more in 2019, the smart speakers, which the Echo and Google Home and all of that, Apple HomePod, and they were, well, Amazon's Echo was the biggest thing that they sold on Black Friday. It'll probably be the biggest thing at Christmas. This is a cultural trend. This is not just a technological blip. So I think this is fascinating. Also, this quote, we've got stuck in the idea that there's one story, that we need to make the same story work for audio, ebook, etc. We need to start thinking about how to adapt stories. And that leads me into the personal update. So yes, my personal update, I went to London and I had another voice coaching session in a studio with my voice coach, who is fantastic. He's an actor, and really it's so fascinating. I feel that I started out this sort of learning about narrating fiction in a very almost product-driven mindset. So it was really about, okay, how do I get some of my fiction into audio, but also how do I connect with readers, with my fiction readers, in the same way I connect with you guys? So how do I use my voice to connect with fiction? And I was really afraid of this character voice issue, in inverted commas, because there are lots of straight read narrators who don't necessarily read different voices in different ways. Anyway, my coach has really been helping me, I think because he is an actor, but also because he's a voice artist. And I really appreciate, if you're listening and you are a voice artist, a voice talent, it really is an incredible thing. I feel like I'm learning all the time. It's been a bit like my development with yoga, which I've now been doing 3 times a week plus for 2.5 years. And only now I feel like, well, I mean, it's all a journey, right? But I feel like I can connect my body to my brain, you know, when it's like spreading your toes really wide and you can move all your toes individually. That's something, or sitting cross-legged, something I never could do a couple of years ago. And with the voice stuff, I feel much more that I'm understanding how voice works and really learning to manipulate the tool, I guess, or the part of the body that is not just the throat and the, you know, the, but also the chest and the your posture. And so with the voices for characters, we've been doing a lot of stance work and sort of how do you stand if you're this character that affects the way your voice works. How do you, and it, I'm not an actor, so I'm not acting in inverted commas, but I'm trying to access much more of the character. And this is really helping my writing. Seriously, I can't believe it. So 1,000 Fiendish Angels, which is 3 short stories linked by a book of human skin. Yes, I love the anthropomorphic bibliopedgy, I think that's what it's called. But anyway, the 3 short stories are available right now, but I am completely editing them, not to change the story, but to change the language and also to change the dialogue and just generally for voice. So the quote there from the future book about changing or adapting stories for audio just really resonated, because I really am doing that, doing a lot of this. However, I've read these stories now over and over again for kind of practice and done all that, but I have not done the final recording because I'm just about to leave and my voice is just so tired and I've had a bit of a cold and just generally run down from trying to get everything done. I am going to record it in January when I have more energy, because energy is super important in voice, as I think you know, because you listen to podcasts and you can tell whether people have energy or not. So I wanted to just give you that update on the audio, and it's definitely something I thought a couple of weeks ago I was just going to give it up. I was like, oh, this is so much like hard work. And then I felt like I had this breakthrough. So yeah, definitely doing more of that. And in fact, I'm even booked on a full day kind of voice acting narration thing, which I'm a little bit scared of, but I think it's good to push myself out my comfort zone. And as I said, I'm finding it really improving my writing. So I think it's a good investment in that as well. So I also went to an exhibition of Edward Burne Jones at the Tate Gallery this week, 19th century Pre-Raphaelite painter. And he wrote that beauty was the antidote to the crude ugliness and rampant materialism he believed was degrading modern Britain. We're in like 1870 or whatever it was. So I just thought that was a brilliant quote, because this time of year we can sometimes feel that rampant materialism. But he created beauty in his art through paintings, drawings, stained glass, illustrated books, tapestry and woodcuts. And he used mythology to bring depth to his visual stories. And I sent this out in my newsletter this week, but I feel that sometimes, and I, of course, I'm just as guilty as anyone else. I like to keep you up to date on things. I think about it too. But we need to balance this sort of nitty gritty of what it takes to publish and sell books and marketing and blah, 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 and make money. But at heart, we are creators and we write in order to share our form of beauty with the world. So let's create some
beautiful things, whatever beauty means to you and whatever success means to you in the coming year. And also, I really like exhibitions where they show the development of the artist, because, you know, we are creating a body of work, and there is no shame in early work that, you know, we all write stuff that later on where we wonder about. And this is the other thing while editing these stories. I could be like, oh my goodness, I've really, I shouldn't have put that out there, but that's just crazy. And those were commission stories for the launch of Dan Brown's Inferno for Kobo Writing Life. Thank you, Kobo, as ever. And the stories were great at the time, and they served the purpose that they served. And now I am redoing the stories and re-editing the stories in a new way. And what was interesting is Edward Burne Jones, there were a couple of examples of work that he did at an earlier point in his life that he then changed in response to his audience. For example, there's one with basically I had full frontal male nudity, as per Leonardo da Vinci, you know, that kind of art. And he added a ribbon over the naughty bits in a work that he later did exactly the same thing, but much bigger, with an adjustment based on the reaction of his audience. I thought that was fascinating. Also, there was a particularly lovely illustrated Chaucer that he did with William Morris, which really showed the sort of collaboration between artists. So, brilliant exhibition. If you are in London, go check that out at the Tate Gallery. And if you are in London anytime, the Tate Gallery is amazing. Right, couple of useful things. First of all, fancy another podcast, or at least another episode. Orna Ross and I do a advanced session every month on the Alliance of Independent Authors Ask Ally podcast. And we did a session on how to position yourself for success in 2019, which includes focusing on independence, positioning yourself in the market, becoming a better publisher, and making the most of what you have. Oh yes, plus thoughts on audio. Surprise. So I'll link to that in the show notes, or you can, if you just search Joanna Penn on your podcatcher, you'll find it under the Ask Ally podcast for December 2018. Also, fancy some holiday reading? I love these story bundles. If you don't know about Story Bundle, they have bundles of ebooks every week or every couple of weeks. And I've been in lots and I think they're brilliant. They are another form of direct sales to readers. And you basically, it's a kind of pay what you want, and there are certain levels of what you get. And I'm in one and it's called Weird Thrillers. And I think maybe I didn't know the name of it when I gave my book to Kevin J. Anderson, who's wonderful. Hello, Kevin. I think in England, maybe Weird Thrillers are a little different to America. But anyway, I quite like the idea of, like, in Britain, weird fiction is people like China Mieville. It's very, very literary. So these are clearly genre thrillers. And Kevin says, imaginative thrillers, each with a fantasy twist. Some funny, some nail-biting, all enjoyable. So they look like some awesome books. So obviously my book End of Days is in there, but go and check it out at storybundle.com/thriller, and you can decide whether they are weird or not. Fascinating title. Right, so thanks to everyone for all the emails and tweets and comments on the 10 years show, and everybody who said wonderful things. And I really am so thrilled to be part of your author journey. I continue to do this podcast because of the feedback you give me that this is still useful. There are so many podcasts now, and, you know, some days I think I don't know whether I have a place anymore, and I try and adapt depending on what other people are offering so that you still feel you get value here. So this is, again, part of the reason why I bring people like Yarrow on. I want to be an advanced show. I want to share my journey. And even if you're at the beginning, I hope that you still find this useful and that it gives you ideas and that you get ideas from all the guests. So thank you so much. I don't know whether I'll still be doing this podcast in 10 years, in another 10 years. Who knows? But I certainly intend to be around for a while. So I can't read everything because there were hundreds of wonderful comments and tweets and things. But just a few. Claire said, listening to the latest podcast, happy 10-year anniversary. I want to go back in time and give the I'm not creative Joanna a massive hug. And I thought that was lovely because I feel that too. And when I hear people who say, I'm not creative, or I'm just not a writer, or I just don't feel I could write, then those are the people that we need to support. And if you're feeling that now, then please really just move into that space of creativity in 2019. Start saying in your head, I am creative, and do things that might feel a bit silly. Like I remember going to Brisbane, one of the galleries there in Brisbane, and we did like colouring in. We just did some colouring stuff and I just felt this is silly. This is a really silly thing to be doing. But sometimes doing silly things is good for creativity. Oh yeah, and this one, Hannah says, happy Indieversary. I confess that reading it all felt somewhat overwhelming in the sense of how on earth can I keep up with this? But I know that just taking it step by step will be okay. And this is the other thing. I know it can be overwhelming when you listen to this show, or even like when I listen to Yarrow, like when I talk to Yarrow in the upcoming interview, I feel like, how can I get to that point? Because he's talking about investing in various businesses, you know, property investing and cash flow from other investments. And I'm like, okay, well, how do I move to that? Or not move to that, but how do I increase my income streams from those areas? So it is difficult to kind of think about it step by step, but it's the only way. And then finally, just wanted to say thank you to Kristen, who sent a lovely picture. My digital nomads family working in Porto. I'm listening to the podcast, and there were also pictures of Greg and Camilla listening, and they're all sitting around a table listening to different things. So I love that. Really cute digital nomad family. Wonderful. So today's show is sponsored by my own multimedia courses for authors. And I will mention again, I have a new mini course on content marketing for fiction authors, which is basically if you want to build an asset that makes income over and above your fiction book sales for the long term. So as I said before, I have built the Creative Pen off the back of content marketing over the last 10 years. And now I'm going to do the same for my fiction, and I will be sharing this and updating this course. So the course is ready for you right now, but I am actually going to be updating it in 2019 as I build the new site, the new podcast, the new brand, and I will be sharing, you know, the choices I make around building the website, doing the SEO, the strategy. And so essentially you're going to see how it works in real time. And that is only $99 US plus your local digital tax. Because it's just different per country. But if you are a patron, or you are you've done some of my other courses, like how to write a novel or how to write nonfiction or any of the other ones, you have a discount coupon, so you can get money off there. I also am going to do a mini course on productivity in January, because so many of you have asked for that. And I quite like these mini courses because they don't take forever to do and they're very useful. And it means I said I wouldn't do any more nonfiction books next year, but I will be doing these mini courses. So go to thecreativepen.com/learn. And as ever, thanks to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Dharma Kelleher, Marjorie Witt, Charles Forness, Amy Berinda, Sean Locke, Kirk White, Jordan L. Hawk. And thanks also to Jack F. Erickson for increasing his pledge. And I really appreciate your Patreon support. Like the tweets and emails, it demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And I sent out the extra Q&A this week. So you get an extra like 40 minutes of Q&A per month for less than a coffee a month. And you can also get the whole backlist and also the 10% off my courses. So you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get on with the interview with Yarrow. Today, I'm back with Yarrow Starak. Hi, Yarrow.
Hi, Joanna.
It's great to have you back on the show. Just in case people missed the last two we've done over the years, Yarrow is a blogger, podcaster, entrepreneur, angel investor, and digital nomad. And his most recent company is Inbox Done, which manages email for busy professionals, which I know everyone will love. And his Blog Profits Blueprint and course taught me how to make money online 10 years ago. And we're talking about my 10-year anniversary and what Yarrow has learned over more than 10 years. So very excited about today. So Yarrow, let's just wind the clock back. So 10 years ago, you were in Brisbane, Australia. So was I. I learned from you. And I wanted to ask you first, like, what has changed the most in 10 years? So like, what are the big shifts that you think have happened in the online space since 2008?
Yeah, a long time ago. I wonder if Brisbane was the glue that got us together, I think. There,
oh, probably, or just you know. Were online so early. I don't know what Australia was doing, but it really was a good hub, I think.
I wonder if you were in the UK when I was in Brisbane, you would have found me. I always find it interesting how the offline connection can impact the online connection. So anyway, just reminiscing after 10 years, you know, it's a long time. So.
Well, we should say, like, then before we get into it, we're both introverts and I didn't actually meet you for, I think, 3 years. And I actually saw you at a bar. I think I've told you this before. I saw you at a bar and I didn't come and talk to you because I was so fangirly that I just couldn't, speak to you.
That's hilarious.
That is hilarious. Anyway.
At least we had a good meetup in the UK recently.
Yes, we did. Yeah, we did. Okay, so what's changed in 10 years?
What's changed? So what was the question? What's changed in 10 years, right?
Yeah.
So, well, you know, it's the obvious thing is it's way more crowded. I think that's always the case with any emerging industry. You know, when I started, the internet was already 7-8 years old as a, you know, place to do business. Amazon was like mid-90s starting to take off. So, for me, though, you know, like yourself, probably for 10 years ago, when we started, you could start writing content, you could publish sort of without not knowing what you're doing or where you're going, but people would start showing up and reading your work. And then you kind of almost like guide yourself as you go, you know, decide what you're going to do as you start getting feedback from your audience. Nowadays, I think, you know, that kind of slow determining what you do may not get you anywhere because you're just not going to organically grow an audience without being a lot more specific and clear about who you're helping and what you're helping them with. So it's just a standard answer, really, because the more crowded an industry gets, the more specialized and more specific you have to be with whatever it is you're doing. You know, I think back in the day, you probably could have gone on and said, well, I just help people publish books. And now how many other people are going to say, I help people publish books, right? Mm. Same with me. How do you, I teach how to make money blogging. But now you kind of have to say, well, yeah, I do that. But, you know, here's my specialty. I really like email marketing. And I'll teach you how to sell information products, you know. And and you might say, well, I'll specifically teach you how to do, you know, it could be crime novels or something like that. You become more specialized. So I think that's the biggest change. And that's then reflected in the tools we have. And in a sense, when I started, social media was blogging. You know, that was it. There was no, YouTube, I think, was just getting started. It was basically blogging, podcasting, and Google as a search engine. That was it. So we didn't have Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or Snapchat or, you know, all these other tools where people go and get distracted now by all this, you know, instantaneous addicted social streams of content, which I think is a little bit sad because it kind of takes away from what I used to really enjoy, which was long form content that people really, you know, dug into. And you had this sort of community at your blog. And that's very hard nowadays. Now it's more like, you know, short bursts of quick flashing video entertainment, you know, the cats and the whatever, the babies on Facebook. And that's it, right?
Well, it's interesting because when I first found you, you had the long posts. You still have the long posts, but you also had the audio. So I don't think it was even called, it kind of was podcasting, but it wasn't big then. I used to download your MP3s, put them on my mini iPod, and then plug a tape into the tape machine in my car, which had an adapter to my iPod.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then I remember listening to you when I would drive to Brisbane. I was living in Ipswich, so I was driving. And then also when I was on the train. And so to me, I still think of you as someone I've learned from through audio. Mm. So, but what has changed, I think, is the rise of audio. And you still have a podcast. And of course, this is my podcast.
Yes.
And which I did because I learned from you with audio. So perhaps what's changed is that the long text, like you read your long text, right, out some of your shows.
No, I mean, I did that for Blogmastermind version 1.0. That was the only time I ever read out lessons. I still riff, I guess, is the best way to put it. When I do my solo episodes, it's not like, you know, reading a transcript or anything like that.
So. But you have a long, like your Freedom post, which we'll come back to, but that had a long blog post, but then there was an audio that went with it.
If the blog post would have been over my team. I don't think there was a long one on that one. Yeah, that was especially more recently with my solo episodes. I don't know about you, but it'll be like, here's my notes. I get on the audio, I hit record, and then I see what the universe brings me, and that's what comes out.
So. Okay, well then I'm a lot more the other way. Then I still write. I'll write 5,000, 10,000 words, and then I'll turn that into an audio.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, though, isn't it? Because I had thought you were doing the same thing, but yours going audio to text, whereas I'm still kind of going text to audio.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'd want to write what I say sometimes because there's so much of
so much filler like we're doing.
Yeah, exactly. It'll take too long.
Yeah,
but I think writing is more succinct, and that's why I like to sit down and, you know, write a blog post, and then like we're doing now, we're totally riffing, right? So,
but this is cool because I love having some of your time. It feels very precious. But the other thing I guess I just wrote down when you were talking about it is crowded. But I feel like the personal brand aspect, do you think that, I mean, like you could have written anything, but your personality has been the thing that has kept people being drawn to you. So I know people listening are now worried that they can't stand out in any niche. So what do you think about personal brand and the importance of that?
Yeah, we should probably talk about what to do in a crowded space. That's an important question. So, yes, you're spot on. I think the one element that hasn't changed is this idea of the cult of personality or a personal brand. And we've seen that just become more magnified with, you know, a YouTube personality or and podcasting personalities, whatever. It's that sense of connecting with one individual. And that's especially in a sort of a coach client relationship or coach student or, you know, member, that becomes really important, because I think what does happen in crowded spaces is if you're smart, you start to ignore everyone except for the one or two people you really connect with. You know, there's the Joanna fans, there's the Yarrow fans, and they've carried with us since we, you know, first got discovered by them. And that's something that, you know, it's a relationship. You can't really replace that quickly. And they'll always pay attention to you. So that's, I'm a big fan of the old Kevin Kelly 1,000 true friends concept. That simple idea, you just need to find 1,000 people who love your stuff and buy your stuff from this huge internet made up of over a billion people. And then that becomes your core income base, you know, your audience, your traffic. Doesn't have to be millions of views on YouTube or millions of downloads of a podcast or, you know, hits to your blog. It's just that core audience. And that's become more and more important to me as well over time. The funny thing is, I've had people, after saying something like what we're saying now, say, well, I don't want to be a famous brand or put my face on the internet as well. And then it's like, okay, so it's crowded. The only way to break free from the crowd is to become a personal brand so you can have your own audience. But I don't want to do that either. And I think the next option for those kind of people is you know, what is the angle you can take? For some people, it's the product itself. Mm-hmm. Like I remember quite recently, I was at a little meetup in Vancouver where we were listening to the founder of a cat subscription of the month box product. So they essentially sell a box that has stuff for your cat in it, you know, like little balls to play with, you know, little treats. And you get this sent in the mail once a month with different things, and it's a subscription. And that's their business. It's called Meow Box, I think. And, you know, we heard from the founder, but it was the product itself and that idea that was really getting, you know, the traction, helping them stand out. They were getting other Instagram influencers to promote that box, for example. Mm. Now, that might not be as defensible long-term as a personal brand, because you can replicate the cat box idea, but you can't replicate Joanna Penn, so to speak. So, but there are ways to come up with, you know, innovations that allow a company, whether it's a certain product category or just your philosophy on customer service, you know, there's things you can do that allow you to, again, just get that 1,000 true fans, because, you know, they just want to buy your shoes because the way you hand make them, and it's amazing, and they feel special having, you know, this handcrafted product. So I think the key here, it's kind of like an interesting inverse of the idea of a really crowded internet where people just have trouble paying 1 second of attention to things. And the antidote to that is doing something that's unique and special enough, whether it's your personality or your product or your customer service, that allows you to create this relationship with a small group of people mm-hmm. that then cuts through the noise. So I think that's kind of like the answer, the antidote to a more crowded space. But really the foundation of that, though, is specialization. You know, Joanna is a specialization. You know, mm-hmm. that's your personal brand. So I think that's always been the key as markets mature. It's just the way, you know, human beings work.
Yeah, I really agree with you on this. I don't think that has changed. As you said, that's something that's kind of stayed the same. And the other, I also wanted to say to you, I was reflecting on my 10 years. And one of the things that you taught me early, and also because I came from software, is you said, build your site on WordPress. And, you know, you advocated quite a simple setup, I believe, you know, and then because I came from software, I was like, yeah, you buy out the box and then you don't mess with it and it will be fine. And I have spent very little money on my website over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And that's thanks to you as well, because so many people seem to build crazy websites and then have to pay massive maintenance costs as things change. So, you know, what are your thoughts on websites now? Like if you were starting, do you still recommend WordPress? Like what's your thoughts on mobile optimization, that type of thing?
Yeah, I think that idea that you're talking about there was born from my own sort of overwhelm of, you know, I know when I got started, it was kind of simple because a new piece of software would show up. Like I remember Marketer's Choice came up, which was a kind of like the first all-in-one marketing tool I came across. It had email marketing and had a checkout so you could sell your products. It was all integrated. And I signed up for their free trial and I went in there and I'm like, wow, I could create these products and there's an affiliate marketing module. So I could have affiliates promote it and then I could link with upsells. And I was like, whoa, there's so many things to do here. And it really got me pumped up for the future. But then I never actually started to use any of those tools and I never actually paid money for that software. Mm-hmm. And that forced me, not just that, but also just the idea of the 80-20 rule, for example, you know, trying to get what are the most important variables. And I kept looking back at my current business structure and I was like, you know what, as long as I've got people subscribing to my email list, and that's all coming from my blog, so I just need content on the blog driving people to sign up to an email newsletter, and that's driving whatever sales I make, whether it's affiliate marketing, which I started with, then switching to my own products. And then of course when I came to switching to my own product, like you said, it was the same story. How can I not deal with overwhelm and ship faster? You know, it's all about getting something out the door and making those first sales. And for me, as I think sounds like for you as well, it was let's use WordPress. Let's put just a basic generic password in the members area, give them a download link, and away you go. You know, you don't need to have even things like a unique password for every member. I remember this. I had my members email me saying, oh, you know, here's my password and username, when they wanted to do something. And they didn't all realize that they all had the exact same password and username, including yourself, Joanna.
And I did that too. Right. I did that too for years until I started on Teachable.
Yes, yeah, and it's such a simple thing. And okay, there's a few risks inherent in giving a generic password to the entire population. You could share it and they can get in. But, you know, I wasn't worried about a few people stealing my course versus just getting something out the door as fast as I could. Now, fair enough, today we do have, Thinkific and Teachables and, you know, Kajabis and all these optimized press. But I would still argue that you want to find the tool that allows you to get something out the door. And that's often less is more in terms of things. 80-20 rule, big part of how I've gone about doing things. So today I use one tool. So even when I made the switch from a password for everyone, the same password for everyone, I was looking at what tool to use. I ended up choosing, obviously played around with a few different things, but Ontraport ended up being my choice, and it still is today. I think it's almost now been about 6-7 years. And again, although Ontraport does a crazy amount of things, I was kind of comparing it to Infusionsoft around the same time. Tons of our fellow marketers were talking about Infusionsoft. And I think James Schramko was big on Ontraport at the time as well. So I was kind of hearing his referral. Long story short, I jump into Ontraport. I found it the easiest for me to start using. And that was a huge part of my decision making. Plus, it was all in one. So it did allow me to, you know, have the affiliate program there, have the checkout system there, have the email system there. And I liked to avoid what I call Frankenstein syndrome, where you're going and you're taking your WordPress and you're plugging into some sort of WYSIWYG design plugin, which then goes to some kind of SAMCart or ThriveCart check-in system, which then plugs into an affiliate module with another piece of software. And suddenly you've got these five different tools all trying to run this business, but they're not natively designed to work together. And either you, which is a bad idea, you try and figure it out yourself, or your tech bill is just getting more and more and more and more. And I was like, I need to be able to at least do the basics myself first, and then have my one tech person handle the one system. And that's why we're still predominantly the same. We haven't changed. It's really WordPress plus Ontraport. That's all I do. And of course, you know, PayPal, Stripe to take the actual money. That's about it. So it's still pretty elegant.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And many people listening won't have such a developed business as you, obviously, and I don't either. But even just, you know, some of the basic stuff, you know, I still say WordPress and don't mess with it. Like, don't customize even the theme, because you get, you know, the next upgrade and then it breaks and it costs money. So I really like that. That's awesome. So I want to ask you about freedom, because I think, again, this is probably why I was so, into your stuff from so early on, because I heard you talking about the freedom that you had, and I was like, that's what I want. And it's still my number one value. And you did this brilliant episode, which I'll link to in the show notes, an audio with a blog post about freedom. But this is something that I think is almost like a dirty secret of running your own business. It's like, it's really hard work. And I think often I feel like I work, well, I do. I definitely work more hours than I ever did in my day job. I'm more fulfilled, but I work more hours. So can you talk about freedom and work and how you've managed that balance over time?
I'm sure you really love the work you do though, Joanna. So it's not really work, right?
I do. I love it, but I definitely do more hours.
Of course. Yeah. I found myself, especially more recently, as I've kind of been transitioning businesses, where I've had some long stretches where I didn't actually have a lot to do. In the past, it's like I've always been, you know, writing a book or preparing a course or preparing, you know, some sort of training materials or even just writing blog posts. And it's funny because when you take maybe what was your core activity away, you're kind of like, well, how do I fill the hours in my day? You know, it's like, it's not a bad problem to have, but it's a weird kind of situation to be in. So I think the best way to answer this question, though, it really is to go back in time, because I think, like probably most people listening to us, the early phase is a lot different to the phase I've been in more recent years. Early phase is you got to make your money, right? Like I think in the audio you're referring to, the podcast I did, I talk about these three types of freedom that you strive for. The first one being money, financial freedom. It's obviously the most pressing one for everyone. Certainly was for me in the first few years online. So that's when you're kind of like trying to figure things out, trying to make money. You might be having some ideas that work, some that don't, probably very likely some that don't, definitely some that are very slow to get anywhere. That's obviously one of the most frustrating things, is that slow pace. So, you know, as you know, my story, I had this card game business and I had this essay editing company, which then eventually led me to blogging. And we're talking 7-8 years of my life there, trying to get, you know, these different businesses and income streams going. I had a couple of part-time jobs mixed in there during the early days. So that eventually led to what I have done for most of the last decade plus, which is blogging and, you know, selling a course and selling a membership site and ebooks and so on. But that was 9 years to even reach that point where I was, I guess, had the experience and the knowledge to start sharing information on the blog. So it's very much compounding. Now, what I was striving for, and this was something that kind of got a little bit, I guess, developed and nuanced as I went along to realize what this actually meant to me. But I knew in my mind at the start, I don't want a full-time job. I never want a job. I don't want to be in someone's calendar and have to work to their schedule. I don't want to capped by the hour or even, you know, yearly salary income stream. Mm-hmm. I want control over my time, control over my money. And that was my first two goals. That's actually the second of the freedom steps, which was time freedom. So money freedom and then time freedom. So I was very focused on those two with everything I was doing online, must avoid full-time work. Mm-hmm. Then as I started to get some traction, start to get some momentum, you know, most people, if you're lucky, we'll get to the point where you're, I guess, busier than you want to be, but it's because you're actually being successful. You've got customers, you're making sales, you've got people asking for interviews, you're thinking about, I should write a book, I should release a course, I should get more affiliates, I should do this partnership. You know, you got a lot of things, I should speak on stage. Suddenly you're succeeding, but your time freedom has disappeared. Your money's probably gone up, but you've started to hire a team. You're starting to train them. So you've got far less time freedom. And I went through, you know, that phase as well. It's exciting. I definitely prefer that phase to the I don't have any money or no traction phase. a lot more fun to have customers and make money and then, you know, deal with the aftermath of success. Mm. So, but for me, I was very cognizant of the fact that I'd seen other business owners burn out. They were working, as you said, or maybe even what you're doing, more hours than at a job. And I wasn't looking to sign up for a 12-hour a day, pay myself a salary situation. I wanted to also be in control of time. So I, from an early on stage, looked into, simply put, leverage. I read a lot of books. The E-Myth was a very important book in terms of, you know, working not in your business, but working on your business. I wanted to be like an entrepreneur that owned businesses, not a freelancer or a consultant or I guess a sole trader who runs a business, but it's really just you or just you and a small team, but you have to do most of the work. So, for example, my essay editing company, we had contract editors doing the work. And then eventually I hired an email manager to do all the email and the customer service. So that business became what nowadays is very much known as a 4-hour work week business, thanks to Tim Ferriss, you know, but this is before Tim had written his book. Excuse me. And then after that, as I moved on to blogging, even with that, I remember watching, you know, Darren Rouse, our friend from Melbourne, he would just be working so hard. And I was like, he's getting huge results. He still has much bigger business than I ever had. But I remember watching how much time he put in. I was like, I don't want to follow that path. I need to find a way to kind of leverage smarter systems, or I won't say smarter, but more leverage business models, so I can, you know, step away from having to feel like I've got to publish, you know, 5 blog posts a day or something like that. So that's why I started looking at email marketing and selling digital products, because you could set up systems there where those products sell themselves. Mm. Hey, don't get me wrong. You got to work really hard to create the course, to create the audience, to grow your email list. There's a period of time where you are hustling and really putting in the effort. But I stopped doing that, I think, after about my fifth year of blogging. I built up the momentum. I had this sort of flywheel turning. I had an email list. I had a blog ranking well in Google. My list was always growing. My courses were finished. So I could start sort of throttling back a little bit and just letting these things kind of sell themselves. Now, I could have, as a lot of people do, once you reach, you know, I made $500,000 a year in 1 year. And then the most obvious thing is I got to get to 1 million. And I was like, let's just stop and ask myself why and what am I going to have to do to get there? And that was a big turning point for me. About my fourth, fifth year of blogging, where I'm like, there is another layer here which will get me busier and make more money, but it's not going to substantially change my life, because it's not actually that much different to make $500,000 to make $1 million a year. You're already doing really, really well. And I was like, I don't think I want to start the take away all this time. So that's when I kind of realized I'm now in the fortunate position that I can focus on time freedom. Financial freedom is ticked off. Let's look at how to structure a business that allows me to just do the one or two things I really like. So I still wanted to write. I still wanted to do podcasts, but that was about it. So I kind of pulled back on anything heavy growth. And then, you know, fast forward to, I guess, the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, I've taken that to the next level where I've started to invest in new businesses with partners, another form of leverage, because, you know, I bring something, but they do the day-to-day operations of a business. So I have a solar energy company that my partner is getting up and running. And the one you mentioned at the beginning, Inbox Done, it's kind of like my main growth project at the moment. And I'm out there talking about it, promoting it. I certainly do a lot of the sales and the marketing. But Claire, my co-founder, she's running my team, or our team. She's supporting all the clients. She's managing everything. So she kind of runs the business while I try and keep it growing. And again, that's a lot different to, you know, me doing both roles. If I didn't have a Claire, I would be full time. She's, you know, putting in a lot of hours to do that. So that's another way to kind of get the leverage. But I really feel like you kind of have to take these steps. And I think, and I have always said this, I really wish for everyone listening to this, they get to the point where they don't have to decide what to do purely based on how much money they're going to make from something. When you get to go, I want to do this because I'm excited about the project. Money would be great too, but it's not the be end all. I don't have to decide this because I need to pay my bills from the money I would make from this project. That's a really interesting situation, because you're like, what, you know, I faced this when I had the opportunity to speak on stage a lot. And you'll know this as an introvert. You don't do a lot of speaking on stage, I know. And there was an opportunity to become a paid speaker. I could have traveled around Australia, make $1 million a year selling these high-end courses as a paid speaker. But then I was kind of, you know, learning about the process. And it was like living in a suitcase, spending almost, you know, every weekend, or at least 1 or 2 weekends every month at an event, doing the same talk, trying to sell people into this high-end course, and then delivering the high-end course over another weekend workshop. And it was great money, but I was like, I'm not this person. I'm not the person who wants to be on stage all the time, you know, 2 or 3 times a year. Fun. Every second weekend, not so fun. So that was just me. And that's that was a choice I could make then, because I didn't need to do that task because I didn't need the money. So just to summarize, I know I've been riffing here on a lot of things. It was a process of moving from financial scarcity to paying my bills, to then hopefully moving above that, which I was able to, which then allowed me to choose, or even while I was doing that, choosing a business model that gave me time freedom. So I don't know how many hours you're doing, but I work maybe 1 or 2 hours a day. I just do a bit of writing and coordinate my team at the moment. So it's certainly not a 10-hour a week kind of job, a day kind of job. And then after that was the final thing I talked about in the audio, which is mental freedom. And I think that's something we kind of take for granted, because as we get success in anything, our mind starts to think about it all. Like, oh, I have to, you know, write that thing. I have to tell my team to do that. I have to hire this person. I have to be here or there. I have to plan this next phase, learn this new software. And that's another form of lack of freedom. So for me, going through those phases from money to time to mental freedom, and that's a 10-year process to be, you know, really fair on how long it took, was revolutionary at the end of the day. You know, it's allowed me to live, I guess, the last 4 or 5 or 6 years of my life being very flexible, not being stressed at all about, you know, how things work, because I was very selective with what I was doing. And then moving on to, you know, really big fun things like investing in a few companies, starting a few, but within partnerships. So that's a real evolution. I think I've kind of talked about 20 years of my own entrepreneur's journey here, but that's kind of the process is taken to reach the kind of freedom I think that I thought back when I was 18, which is 20 years ago, thinking this is what I want for my future. I didn't expect it to sort of happen the way it happened or how it looks now, but fundamentally what I wanted back then is certainly, you know, what I've lived for the last maybe 10 years, so which is amazing.
It's funny because And again, you know, we're very similar characters, I think, because people listening will know that I've just recently said no to all speaking engagements for 2019. I've just said no. And the last 10 years, I really have been, I haven't done a lot. Like you said, I haven't been a full-on professional speaker, but it was a big part of my income at the beginning, as you were teaching about scalable income. And I was like, and I phased it out over time. But what you're talking about, I think, is exactly where I really am at that point where I could, you know, that it's should you aim for seven figures and why? Why mm-hmm. should you? And if you do, then yeah, you have to hire more people. You have to, you know, I could hire a CEO for my publishing side. But of course, the other thing with writers listening, many people are writing books because we love writing books. So we're never ever going to, well, for me, you're never going to outsource that because that's kind of what you do.
That's what you do, yeah.
Yeah, that's what you do. So that's part of the enjoyment of that. It's just all the other stuff. So it's really interesting to hear you talk about that. So I did just want to briefly touch on the multiple streams of income and scalable income, because again, I think that's something that you taught me early on, and you've kind of touched on it a bit, but that concept of scalable is a mindset shift, and also multiple streams. So how, just explain that briefly, and then what are your multiple streams in kind of broad categories?
Yeah, so I think when I was just, you know, learning about this idea of multiple streams of income, this is the most exciting concept ever. If you really think about it, you know, anytime you hear that, ooh, that's multiple streams of recurring income to me. I remember thinking about that, sounds genius, you know. And for when I was doing that, I was also very cognizant of the previous ways I'd made money, which was part-time job. I had an e-commerce business where I'd make a tiny profit margin selling this little Magic the Gathering collectible card game, and I'd have to run down to the post office box to send all these packages, and it, you know, wasn't scalable. I mean, it was possible to scale it, but I was no interest in doing that. Margins were tiny. So it's like, okay, not good. Got out of that business. Then I certainly made a quantum leap in scalability when I jumped into this essay editing company, where I'm like, well, I can scale this because I can hire contractors. That's the difference. I'm not selling this finite product. It's a service. I can find new people to deliver the service. So I can essentially take as many customers as I want. And because the system is so elegant, we essentially, you know, we get a customer, we forward an email to the contractor, they forward it back to the customer. I take a 50% cut of the transaction. Away you go. Very much modeled on eBay. I was like, eBay sounds genius. You bring the buyers and the sellers together. They take a cut of the transaction. They just have the platform. And I was like, that's what you want. You want to own the platform. You want to own the, you know, the middleman of a transaction. So I was kind of doing that with that company. The funny thing is, after discovering my joy of writing through blogging, which is my next project, I did not see that coming. I didn't see myself as a writer, as you know, maybe a lot of your audience did or did not, whatever we are. So I was like, how do I create scalable leveraged income as a writer? And that was an important thing to sort of think about. Bearing in mind, I was still very green and fresh at this. And sure, I thought, oh, published author. Yeah, I can be the next whatever, right? You know, you can make a ton of money if you're the top of the tree, the 0.001% of authors. And I was like, okay, that's probably not going to happen. It could happen, but I'd never written a book, and I wasn't about to sit down and write one. But I was writing blog posts and getting traction. And at that time, bloggers were just paid per essentially advertising. And that's what I started with too, advertising and affiliate marketing. And that was all about pumping out lots of content, lots of page views, make more money. But I looked at that, I'm like, that's not going to work either, because I'm stuck here writing 5 blog posts a day and the money's just getting less and less and less as the internet gets more crowded. So that's when I discovered the joy of email marketing. And I think that was a huge turning point for me to see that you can use content and you can sell content and you can reach this niche audience. So going back to sort of the 1,000 true fans idea, because I really made most of my money from 1,000 paying customers. You know, despite reaching 1 million people a year with blogging and podcasting and so on, it's been 1,000 people who actually pay my bills and allow me to run a business. So that's really held true, that kind of rule. And I started looking then at the business models of bloggers and email marketers. I realized there was a way to kind of merge those two and get the best of both worlds. So blogging is great for growing an audience and using content, but not like, you know, we're talking 2,000, 3,000 word blog posts. So I wasn't having to write a book every 6 months to try and, you know, make my living. Nothing wrong with that, of course. I know Joanna's audience is doing that all the time. But, you know, I could sit there and write these blog posts that will continue to deliver Google traffic, grow my email list. And in the final, really, the power is the automated emails. That was where the leverage, the system came from. So by this point, I had already, I guess, secured a form of multiple income streams in the sense that I'd grown a blog and I made money from advertising. It was not huge, $1,000 a month, $2,000 a month, but it was fairly consistent for a number of years before I gave that one up. Affiliate marketing was great too. At one point, I would make almost $100,000 a year just recommending other people's products using my blog and my email list. Before that, I'm selling services with this essay editing company, and there was some crossover where I had that company at the same time as I was blogging. So, you know, there already was this point where I'm like, oh, I've got a services company, I've got digital products that I'm selling on my own, I've got affiliate products that I'm selling from other people, and I've got advertising on my blog and making money from that. So I was already realizing that now, multiple streams of income are really a byproduct of creating some kind of value in the world, growing an audience. And then you can decide, how do I want to create income from this? So eventually I got rid of some of those streams, advertising, and I stopped doing very much affiliate marketing just because I didn't find those as high return as creating a digital product, supporting a clientele, launching a course, you know, really diving into that. And then fast forward, using autoresponders, so automated email sequences to deliver a series of content that you wrote. I've got some series that I wrote 6-7 years ago that continue to deliver value, that sell a product. So I won't dive into it, but I really got into what's called the sales funnel. I called it the blog sales funnel. So having a series of products designed to lead up to each other with different email sequences. And I just spent a couple of years creating a machine, essentially, that was content that's evergreen, that is valuable and free, that promotes my products. My products sell on autopilot, they're digital, and people go in and take a course. And for a long time, especially the last sort of 4 or 5 years, the only job I had was a little bit of coordinating my team, but even that, I had a project manager. The job I enjoy, much like yourself, writing of the blog posts and doing the podcasts. And then once a month, I had to do a coaching webinar with my entire, you know, audience of paying customers. That was kind of it. That was sort of, unless I wanted to do more, but that was the main sort of business. Mm-hmm. Obviously now multiple streams of income is getting a lot more varied. I just exited out of an investment from a company. Mm-hmm. We've just started Inbox Done, and we've reached the point where we're doing 6 figures a year now with our first 10 customers, which is great. So we want to get our next 10 and keep, you know, helping people with their email marketing. Mm-hmm. My solar energy business is, it's more of a, you know, you take a big chunk of money, you put it into the business, and then you start getting it back. And it's a long-term thing, but I will start, you know, earning income from that. That's not a good example of an online business in any sense, but it is something that I've used online income to parlay mm-hmm. into a form of investment that I was very excited about, getting into the green energy space. So yeah, it's a real, I guess, stepping stones. You know, it's, I bought, like, if you flash back, you might remember this, Joanna, but I bought a blog from someone else. And I was one of the first people to actually buy someone else's blog. And this was like early days. People weren't even thinking about buying and selling blogs or websites as a practice. But a friend of mine at the time, way back in 2006, says, I want to get out of this small business niche. He was writing a blog called Small Business Branding. And, you know, I didn't have much money. I had maybe $10,000 in the bank from savings of my essay editing company and my blogging business at the time. And I learned about the blog, and he says, yeah, I want to get out of it. I want to sell it. I said, don't tell anyone yet. I think I want to make you an offer. So I went to bed that night. I thought, oh, I don't have a lot of money. I looked at his numbers and woke up and said, I'll offer you $2,000 US cash. And he said, yes, let's do the deal. I know who you are. It'll be quick and smooth and easy. So I took over the second blog, and I was like, wow, I'm like a mergers and acquisition entrepreneur here. I'm doing like big deals or expanding our company by acquiring other companies. You know, it was $2,000, but it still felt like a huge deal at the time. And again, I won't dive into details, but I did start buying a few more websites around those 2 years there, 2006, 2007, 2008, as a side project. But I was using money I was making from, you know, my core business. And that was a way to kind of expand my empire and build more income streams. So I think the answer or what is exciting about multiple streams of income is, first of all, building one solid, dependable business that pays your bills, that, you know, spins off cash. Try and use a leveraged, systemized business model so that you can step away from it. I think that's more important than anything, being cognizant of the fact that you, if you want to break free, if you want to do more income streams, if you want to do investments, your business can't be something that takes all your energy, because you're going to need a little bit of time to vet these other investments, to, you know, look at partnerships and being able to participate in them. So, you know, systematizing the first business is a huge step towards that, those kind of opportunities. And thankfully, at that time, I got that little taste of buying another business, which has led to kind of expanding my mind on the possibilities of what you can do when you have one solid income stream or one solid business, you know, already running.
Yeah. So I've been looking at your progression, and I feel like in the last couple of years, we've started investing, haven't, you know, done what you've done, like bigger chunks, but we've been investing more because that money can make money through different things. So I think it does feel like that's the next step. It's also a kind of protection for the future. A lot of people, when they're starting out, they're not paying into superannuation. Although in Australia, it's mandatory. You know, in Britain, it's not mandatory. So, you know, a lot of people won't even pay themselves into a pension or, you know, that type of thing. But that mindset shift of that, of the future, is so important. And I've really appreciated seeing how you've expanded past, you know, where you started as well. Yeah. But we're almost out of time. I do have one more question, which is really about the next 10 years. So I hope to continue modeling your journey, you know, on the non-fiction side, not the fiction side, clearly.
Model you on the fiction side.
But looking forward to 2028, which is crazy. Is there anything like you're excited about or you can see coming for people like us who work online, or, you know, any thoughts on like the next 10 years?
Oh, you know, it's funny because I'm about to turn 40. So I guess I'm an adult when you turn 40. I've always felt that 40 was the adult year, you know. And it's so different from your 20s, where you're kind of like trying to prove yourself, got to make your basic income. You're always looking at opportunities. You have no assets. You have no leverage, most people anyway. So you kind of have to hustle and make it work. So you look at things with very different eyes to now, where I've got assets. I've got, you know, some businesses. I'm not like hungering to dive into something straight away, especially if it requires a lot of my time. It's more about how can I partner with people, or how can I find newer, exciting, bigger ideas. So now it's to answer the question, I think if I was looking at the world through new eyes, got to make my first business work, it's almost I won't say impossible for me to do it, but it's kind of like I've got distance from what the emotions feel like. But I do know, going back to that era, that one of the most important things that I benefited from were, well, two things. You're like the first one, books. So for me, with books, reading about other entrepreneurs and how they got started, I think that will always be a hugely beneficial thing to do for anyone who's, you know, just getting started, looking for possible opportunities in the future. Because, you know, I read about eBay and I read about Amazon and I read about Napster and I read about, you know, some of these early companies, which made me look for opportunities. I wouldn't have done this essay editing company, you know, 15 years ago if I hadn't read about a guy who did something similar in the United States. And then I wouldn't have started, you know, blogging and podcasting if I wasn't really paying so much attention to all these other bloggers and information marketers. I was subscribing to email lists and I was learning about, oh, there's these other types of email lists, and, you know, suddenly YouTube pops up and then suddenly Facebook pops up and you're always on the cutting edge. And it was interesting because, you know, podcasting shows up and then there's this huge wave. And if you were at the right time in the right place and chose that platform, you could have just ridden that wave, which I did with blogging, you know, and then people did it with podcasting. And now people are doing it or have done it with Instagram. And, you know, there will be the next tool, the next platform. Now, I can't really, you know, guess what that will be. A lot of it's driven by technology. Like, certainly, if we look at the last 10 years, the biggest new platforms are very much driven by our mobile phones, you know, the Instagrams and the Snapchats and so on. And that was a shift in how we consume content from desktop and laptop. Not that those have gone away, but now we're doing desktop, laptop, and a lot of mobile, more mobile than anything else. So a good question to ask yourself is, how are we going to consume content next? You know, what is the next tool for consumption of video, audio. What comes after the smartphone? And I've kind of tried to think about that myself, going how, you know, we do talk about implants, but I think it's getting, that's a little too invasive for most average people. Now, I see the devices getting more implanted in our everyday life, a bit like the Minority Report, where you've got your little screen popping up, or your kitchen table has a screen on it, your fridge has a screen on it, you know, the Internet of Things. So that's kind of an interesting idea. Like, if I was really interested in using the internet, and then it's called the Internet of Things, IoT, basically. So looking at our house and where would the internet be useful? Cooking books displayed on your microwave or your stove, you know, those kind of areas. But they're very technology heavy. I think if we're going to look at what we specialize in, which is content, looking at how people are consuming content, where they're consuming it, what they're consuming about, a lot of it hasn't changed. I think this is one of the wonderful things. We're still reading books. Maybe we're doing it on a Kindle more often than in a paperback, but it's still a book. So that hasn't really changed. And I don't know if, you know, we'd have to change the fundamental tools for communication. Like, do we still use languages to communicate with each other? I don't think that's going to change in the near future. We haven't developed telepathy or any kind of thing like that. So I think what we're talking about in terms of content creating isn't going to change. And that's fantastic. It's just, you know, like we talked about right at the start of this episode, you have to specialize, you have to find your personal brand and, you know, do something unique. Outside of that, everything's technology driven. So I would, if you're brand new and you're excited, look at whatever platforms are sort of starting to, you know, gain traction behind the scenes. One of the best opportunities I've seen come and go so many times is just being one of the first people to devote themselves to a new platform. I did it with blogging. A lot of people did it with, you know, Pat Flynn's and the Lewis Howes and the John Lee Dumas's did it with podcasting. You know, sometimes you miss and you're too late or you pick the wrong tool. I mean, I remember Chris Ducker, our mutual friend, he was spending a lot of time on Periscope for a while there. But Periscope just didn't win the kind of instant broadcasting. I think kind of maybe Instagram has won that overall. But again, these are all broadcasting information tools. We haven't even looked at just completely different technologies. So there's so many opportunities. I'm really interested in fake meat products. So
if
I had limited funds right now, I'd probably be investing in fake meat ideas, because I like meat, but I also like animals, and I have a major conflict with those two things. So I want a lot of fake meat options so I don't have to hurt animals to eat meat, you know? So that's an area personally where I would dive into, but not as a beginner. I would go in there, but you could, but, you know, it's a very heavy technology kind of area. I think for our people, just looking at what topics and what platforms are kind of starting up, what apps are gaining traction. You don't have to be the developer of an app. You can just be one of the first users or an early user of an app or a writing tool. I mean, think about Medium. I would have saw that, and I don't know why that did well versus all the other kind of shared content platforms. But if you were one of the earlier users to Medium, or even maybe today, if you just spend enough time there, that's kind of like a place where you could potentially grow a large audience. So it's going where the attention is going. And that goes to usually the innovative ideas, the innovative technology. And then it's kind of like staking a claim to that land for yourself. And I know this sounds very archaic, but I would also add to all of that, make sure you're growing something like an email list as part of whatever it is you do. Like, it's funny. It's not mandatory for every business model, but I think if anyone's focused on content as an author, a blogger, a podcaster, a YouTuber, we all need the email list as kind of like the glue that keeps it together. So I would remember that, even though it's the oldest technology of the internet, it's actually still the one driving most of the sales, which you probably experience every, you know, Black Friday that comes around, and you get all these stupid emails of all these products that you can buy. So it's still driving a lot of the commerce online.
Yeah, and it's good to kind of circle back, because that hasn't changed and that probably won't change. So that's, you know, there are still these fundamentals. So that's fantastic. So just tell people, where can they find you and where can they find your inbox done, in case anyone's interested, and your wonderful site as well?
Yes. So for my content, I've switched to a very simple domain name, yaro.blog. So yaro.blog. Used to be known as Entrepreneur's Journey, but I've phased out that domain name. It's just too long, too hard to spell. So yaro.blog. And inbox done. We haven't really talked much about, I guess, email as a way to break free, but that's what I am primarily focused on now, which is this idea of having someone do your email for you. I know, Joanna, I've tried to see if you need this service, but it sounds like you've got your email handled already with internally. But basically, I brought on someone to do my email a long time ago. 12 years ago was the first time I had someone handle my email. And then every business I had since then, I've had someone basically doing email, customer support, whatever comes into my inbox. It's like a front line of defense, like a receptionist, like a customer service person. And in the last couple of years, I realized this is actually a service that other entrepreneurs really need. It's amazing how many entrepreneurs still do their own email, despite how successful they're getting. They just can't let go of that area. And that's often what's stopping them from getting this freedom that we really kind of talked a lot about in this episode. So me and Claire, my co-founder, we decided to co-launch this new company. And as I said earlier, we've gone past our 10th client now. It's exciting. A lot of people were helping who are not doing their own email anymore. So if that's exciting to you, inboxdone.com is the place to go.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Yarrow. It's been so great to catch up. And again, thank you for setting me on the journey 10 years ago. And I'm going to keep looking at what you're doing along the next 10 years.
Thank you, Joanna. And congratulations. I know I said this to you off air, but I'll say it to you on air as well on 10 years. It's actually quite difficult to stick to one thing for 10 years on the internet. You know, it requires a true passion for what you're doing, but also a successful business, because you don't want to do something for 10 years without actually succeeding at business. So, you know, you've got those two unique things happening, longevity and success, which makes me feel that you probably will be around doing something quite similar in 10 years' time. We can do the 20-year celebration.
Oh, goodness.
Using holographic phones for consuming our books. That could be the next technology. But, yes. You know, definitely. It will definitely be in, you know, automated cars and things like that. But, yeah, congratulations and keep up the good work.
Thanks so much. So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Yarrow today. And when I think about my next 10 years, I am aiming for some of the same goals around freedom of time and mindset, as well as investments that give me more multiple streams of income. And I'll talk about that along the way as we continue the podcast journey together. And of course, if you want to check out Yarrow's fully updated blog profits blueprint, you can use my link if you fancy at thecreativepen.com/blog blueprint, or one word, and I'll link to that in the show notes. So next week, I'm talking about the indie author mindset with Adam Croft, and I will also do an intro from Auckland in New Zealand. So happy writing week, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.